Hello, everyone. My name is Bruce McConnell, and I'm the Global Vice President of the East-West Institute and head up EWI's Global Cooperation in Cyberspace program. Welcome to another episode of the EWI podcast, a platform where we explore some of today's key global issues with leading thinkers and analysts. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming Latha Reddy, former Deputy National Security Advisor of India, where she was responsible for cybersecurity, and Scott Charney, Vice President of Security Policy at Microsoft. Scott and Latha, welcome to the EWI podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Importantly, Scott and Latha both play key roles as part of the Global Commission on the Stability of Cyberspace. Latha is, in fact, a co-chair of the commission. The GCSC is a group that works on developing rules of behavior for states and non-state actors and processes for making those rules work so we have more responsible and better behavior in cyberspace from the cyber powers. So what is a norm for cybersecurity, and what's the objective of introducing norms? Latha, you want to start?
You know, I think that basically you can't really function in any field without some sort of written guidelines that everybody subscribes to. I know there's been a lot of talk about norms not necessarily having ruled out nuclear proliferation or chemical weapons and other things, but just imagine how bad it would be if we didn't have the norms that we have, if we didn't have the organizations that we have. It would really be the Wild West out there, you know, because everybody would be free to develop and use anything. Hopefully, the norms and the mechanisms that have been evolved for certain areas do help to restrain the activities of most countries. You'll always have rogue countries, rogue individual players who can't be completely controlled. But I prefer to think that if you didn't have any norms at all, it would be much, much worse. So for that reason, and this is a relatively new medium, cyber, and with any new technology, we have to do some new regulations. We have to come up with out-of-the-box thinking without stifling innovation, without stifling a free flow of ideas and interesting new technologies coming up. We have to figure out a way to deal with them. And I think the way is to use a multi-stakeholder approach to evolve norms that everybody is comfortable with. How you actually implement them is another question.
Absolutely. Well, you certainly come primarily from a government background, is that governments are big players in cyberspace and are the source of some of the bad behavior. But what about the companies? What responsibilities do they have? And is the commission looking at rules or norms for company behavior?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the interesting things about the internet is it's a shared domain. So you have nation states, of course, and non-state actors, and you have companies who have built and maintained the internet. And so figuring out what the right rules should be and how they should be enforced are going to affect everyone, not just governments. In fact, when you see an attack on the internet, even a nation-state to nation-state attack, often the first responders are actually the private sector. Mm-hmm. If you see a nation-state, for example, leveraging a vulnerabilities in Windows, it's Microsoft is going to patch it. Or if you see them using some kind of malware, it might be private companies that distribute new signatures to block it. And so there's no way to do this just as a nation state or a private sector activity. It really has to be everyone.
So what are some of the kinds of behavior that we're seeing today that we shouldn't see, and how is the commission addressing those things? What's an example of one of these norms you're talking about?
So one of the interesting things is what we call short of war activity. You can think about, for example, the malware attack on Sony. Had another country drop bombs on Sony's headquarters and disabled them, people would say that's an act of war. You dropped a bomb on someone else's territory. But if you attack them through cyber, you can disable them and have the same effect. But no one would call that an act of war. And so when you see something like malware in the power grid, that if activated could shut down critical infrastructure, what should the rules be for those kinds of things? How do we start getting countries to think about the impact to the general civilian population and not just their state objectives? And so the commission's looked at things like and promulgated a norm on protecting the public core of the internet. with the recognition that if people attack DNS servers or other kinds of critical aspects, everyone will be impacted in a very bad way.
So the idea of not taking down the whole internet, even when you're using cyber weapons, because I guess we have to recognize that states will probably continue to build cyber arsenals. Mm-hmm. What about that?
Well, I think the real issue is not whether or not states build cyber arsenals, but how will states use those cyber arsenals? If you're talking about deterrence, and the idea is a sort of a no-first-use policy, as you've had in nuclear, I don't see a problem with people having the means to attack, as long as there's a commitment not to attack, which is where, again, you know, the norm would come in, international agreements would come in, international cooperation would come in. So I know the processes are very, very slow, but we have to remember that anything worthwhile which we've achieved in terms of international negotiation has never been quick. Mm. It's always taken a very long time, and we're really at the beginning stages here. But that doesn't mean we give up. We soldier on ahead, we kind of identify the areas where we feel every stakeholder, every country has some interest in seeing that there's no misuse of cyberspace in those areas. Let's take a simple thing. Let's take the financial system. Now that the financial system is so globalized and interlinked and using cyberspace in such a major way, if one bank is taken down in one country, the chances are that there'll be a domino effect, because all financial institutions will get affected to a lesser or greater degree. If a stock exchange in a major country, a major financial market, gets attacked, it's going to affect prices all over the world. It's going to affect stocks and shares all over the world. So I think this is what is important. You know, if we can say yes, you know, certain things, use of cyber for terror, for example. Mm-hmm. I know defining terrorism has been a problem in the past when, for instance, as you all know, India tried to come up with a convention, a global convention on terrorism, to fight against terrorism. And one of the things that got stuck on is, how do you define a terrorist? Because the famous saying, you know, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. Because the ANC would have been regarded as a terrorist in a certain era. But obviously we all recognize today that the ANC were freedom fighters. So maybe they used violent means, which not everybody would condone, but they were fighting for freedom. They were not really terrorists in the sense that we would see a mindless, senseless act of terror today. So I think it's tough, but I think it has to be done. And I think there are enough areas. After all, without really going into deep censorship, I think the world has pretty much agreed on certain areas, like child pornography, for example. There isn't really a debate that there shouldn't be some controls on child pornography on the internet. So why not on certain other kinds of activity as well?
Mm. And I'd like to go back to your question for a minute, because if you think about it, states have armies and they have navies and they have air forces. They have personnel and weapons to deal with domains. And some nation states, many now, view cyber as just a domain of warfare. Mm-hmm. So you should expect them to build capability, build weapons, build defenses and the like. But just like we don't allow the indiscriminate use of those other weapons, you're not supposed to bomb hospitals, for example, and you're not supposed to bomb civilian populations. The question is, how do those kinds of norms that have grown up over the years apply to this other domain as countries start to enter that domain? And part of the goal of the commission and others working on norms, because there are a lot of people concerned about this, is how do you take what we've learned from the past and apply them to this new domain, instead of just waiting for disaster to happen and then everyone saying, oh, there should be a rule. Maybe we know enough to start crafting some of those rules now.
Well, as Latha mentioned, and you did also, that there's other groups working on this. And Latha, you mentioned how international negotiation takes a long time. The United Nations has had this group of governmental experts that's been meeting for 15 years, mm-hmm. And they've reached some agreements at the expert level, but they're not anywhere like a binding agreement among states. So how does the commission fit into that architecture of different groups that are working? And is there a way that it's going to help speed things up? Because time seems important in this domain.
Well, you know, Bruce, I've worked on two global commissions. The Internet Governance Commission, which was headed by Carl Belt, was in a sense the first experiment at trying to put together a multi-stakeholder group, nothing to do with the United Nations and so on, led really by industry, by think tanks, and to try to come up with some norms. And it was actually called the Global Commission on Internet Governance. I think we made it clear that our Global Commission, the Global Commission on the Stability of Cyberspace, would take over where that left off and build on the work of that. We didn't want to just repeat what the first Global Commission said. And I think that basically, one part of it is identifying what are the norms we can enforce. The second part of it is, how do you build a framework or a mechanism to make norms implementable? Now, for instance, as you said, the UNGGE, or the Governmental Group of Experts, which have met several times actually in the UN, did come up with some generally agreed norms, but they were not binding norms. They were voluntary norms, so which means that they're not enforceable. And a norm in turn has to become law, and for that there's a very long procedure. It first has to become an international law, and then each country has to enact domestic legislation to bring it into actual effect. And it's complicated. So I think one part of the commission's work should also be to outline a mechanism, a possible mechanism, by which we can take the norms that we've identified and create some kind of structure where, again, I feel it should be a multi-stakeholder process, where you can actually make these norms enforceable. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about different things. You know, we've talked about the Helsinki process. We've talked about going the route of civil aviation to follow the ICAO model in Montreal. We've talked about the International Red Cross model. I think people are a little reluctant to go with a purely UN-type organization. But ultimately, that may be the way to go, but detach it from the normal UN procedures. Mm. I personally think the IAEA works very well on nuclear issues. Mm. I've actually been in Vienna. I've been the deputy permanent representative to IAEA. And I was there when India conducted its nuclear tests. And I can tell you that it's a pretty effective deterrent, you know, when 30 countries are standing up and saying what you did was wrong. And it's a different matter that, you know, eventually they have come around to accepting that countries have a right to nuclear defense. And the fact that India said there would be no first use. Mm-hmm. So it may have to be a process like the mm-hmm. IAEA is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. possibly something like ICAO or the Red Cross may be finally more acceptable.
Well, you guys have been thinking about this concept at Microsoft. I think it was a year or two ago that President Brad Smith laid out this idea of a digital Geneva Convention, and also the possibility of some kind of organization that might do some of the things that Latha was speaking about in a multi-stakeholder kind of way. What's going on with that thinking, and is that part of what we need?
Well, yeah, I mean, it continues to evolve. I mean, one aspect of this in terms of the organization is the question of attribution. And in the early years of the internet, of course, one of the reasons criminals love it is it's globally connected. You can be anonymous. It's hard to trace source, and there are really rich targets. And, you know, if you look at some of the current attacks, well, often a country says, we've been attacked by X, and X says, wasn't us, and you can't prove it. And so one big challenge is, how do you do attribution? And this is another reason why the public-private partnership is so important, because governments clearly have sources of information that might shed light on attribution, but the private sector does too, because a lot of these attacks go over privately held networks. So they have the logs and other kinds of things. And then, you know, the notion of the Digital Geneva Convention was really just the idea at its core that in terms of kinetic attacks, there are norms and rules that countries play by, like you don't bomb hospitals and things like that. But there doesn't seem to be any parallel for the internet today. And so the idea, which continues to evolve, is, okay, what should the norms be? How do you protect civilians in this shared space? How do you think about attribution? And then, of course, the big question is, even if you can do attribution, okay, what happens to the actor? And, you know, obviously there's a big difference between state and non-state actors. With a non-state actor, they can be arrested, prosecuted, or whatever, assuming you can find them and get the evidence you need. But with state actors, it's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And so attention does have to now turn, I think, to a greater degree on how do you get states to play by the rules that they have agreed to. You know, often it's easier to get mind share on some things than to get action. You know, if you have a good concept, people say, yeah, that sounds right, that sounds right. Okay, now you need to do something about it. Oh, that's hard. And so we have to make that transition. I think a lot of the discussions so far, both in the UN and the Global Commission and elsewhere, is, okay, what rules make sense? And I think there are certainly differences around the world, but in some places, people do agree on the rules. The idea is that you shouldn't attack a critical infrastructure and turn out the lights of everybody. You know, people go, yeah, and you shouldn't attack hospitals so that patients die. Oh, yeah, no, that sounds right. Okay, but now how do you actually make sure people are adhering to those rules?
Well, one of the things that you were pointing out with the atomic energy regime is that there's a little peer pressure that goes on. There's this concept in our business of naming and shaming. So those are two different things. But one of the things we're talking about here is there needs to be some sort of moral opprobrium for bad actions in cyberspace, as opposed to just anybody can do whatever they want. It's the Wild West.
Well, I think one of the concerns is there has been, over the last few years, quite a bit of naming and shaming at times, and it hasn't always changed behavior.
Right.
It turns out some people are hard to shame. And so that's why when you see what has been happening more recently with threats of sanctions or disruptions of trade deals and other things, this is a way to put some meat on that bone and say, it's not just that we're going to call you out and hope that you're so ashamed you change your behavior, but there are going to be real repercussions. The question is, you know, what are the right kinds of repercussions, both in terms of whether they'll be effective and whether they'll be proportionate. You know, you don't want to escalate things, but you do want to change behaviors. And these are obviously hard questions, particularly on the internet, because, you know, with kinetic things, people kind of have an intuitive grasp of what's going on. So, you know, if you drop a bomb and you kill people, everyone goes, okay, we understand that, you know. On the other hand, when someone breaks into another entity's computer systems and steals all this personal data and information, what does that mean? Like, how riled up do people get? And it seems to happen all the time. And what's the actual harm that occurred as a result of it? Mm-hmm. And so the way humans react to these non-kinetic events is just emotionally different than to kinetic tragedy. You know, we have to think about how do you motivate people to be concerned about these things and understand the impact when it's not intuitive the way it is with a kinetic attack.
But if I could add to that, you know, at the same time, privacy, I find it very interesting because, you know, people are prepared to share a lot of data very openly, not necessarily online. Like, after all, when we apply for a visa, for instance, many of us who apply for a US visa or an American visa, a European visa, have to give our biometrics, right? But we give that quite freely. But when somebody says your biometrics are going to be stored online and someone has the ability to access that data, we get very, very upset. And so I find it very odd, you know, we agree to a physical search in an airport. you give all kinds of details. For instance, if you're from a developing country and you're coming for a US visa or a European visa, you have to give your income tax returns. You have to give record, your bank records. I mean, I don't because I have a diplomatic passport, but you know, the average Indian applicant would have to give that. And that's very intrusive data. Yeah. You're putting a lot of stuff out there. But people give that without thinking, right? But when you say your bank accounts could be accessed on the internet by a company, the reaction is quite different. You know, the same way you argue that violation of law online is the same as violation of law offline, you know, the violation of international law. Surely the same thing should apply for privacy, and yet we very obediently and quietly accept all kinds of invasion into our privacy in the kinetic world, as you said. But we react very violently. We see it as somehow stifling our freedom of expression when it's done online.
In some cases, that's true. But let me give you a counterexample.
Yeah.
If you were walking down the street and someone walked up to you and asked you for personal information, you'd probably be very nervous.
Yeah.
On the other hand, people online ask you for personal information all the time and you share it.
That's right.
Because there's no sense of physical danger.
Mm-hmm.
There's none of that visceral reaction because you feel safe. You're in your own home on a computer.
Mm-hmm.
So what could happen? Well, lots of things can happen.
But
it doesn't feel that way. Whereas when a stranger walks up to you, you often just invoke that flight or fight response that just doesn't happen online. So it is interesting. I think particularly when the tax returns and other things, I think Alan Weston, the late but great professor from Columbia, had it right. He said informational privacy is the right of people to decide for themselves what to share with whom and for what purpose. I suspect people who are sharing their bank account information, for example, is because they want to come to the United States.
That's
and they
right.
feel there's no other choice because they're not going to win an argument with
they
the U.S. government.
They probably don't want to do it.
But they want the outcome, right? And we have this conversation a lot because as someone with children, people say, well, the millennials share everything. It's actually Weston's definition works with them too. They share more, but they share because they want to share with certain people for some purposes. And they get equally outraged when they find out that something else has happened.
Well, of course, all these physical information sharings that you're talking about are stored online somewhere in a U.S. government computer. So we hope the cybersecurity of that is good and no one has tacked their way into those things.
I don't think you want to ask OPM about that. But, okay.
No, indeed. That's right. So where do you see the commission going? How's it going? You have another year, I guess, of work to do. What will success look like?
I would say for me, success would be if we could come out with five or six norms that seem to make universal sense. I don't think we should aim for too many norms. I don't think that's a good idea. And that's something where we could learn from the earlier Global Commission, because that went into a large number of recommendations and a large number of, I wouldn't say norms, but recommendations certainly, you know. And therefore, it became too wide-based in a sense. I think we should concentrate, as I said, on five or six. And secondly, I think we have to map the road ahead. What's going to happen to these norms? How are we going to create an institution or a mechanism that can take them forward? We can give two or three alternatives. And what I'm hoping is side by side with this, when you have initiatives in the UN, which certain governments who are not very happy with purely multi-stakeholder agreements, those governments, I think, would also be satisfied with something that the UN backs. And the fact that Marina Caljurand, who is the chairperson of our commission, the Global Commission, is also on the high-level panel set up on cyber by this UN Secretary General, I think will give a certain synergy to this. And one or two UN agencies, as you know, Bruce and Scott, have come to our meetings and have expressed interest in you know, keeping abreast of what we're doing in the Global Commission. This is something new I see, that the UN is open to a body that is not a government body. We are not representing any one sovereign government. We don't have that official identity. And you know, if the two can go side by side, what I'm hoping is that at some stage we can really start influencing each other, where we then talk about a mechanism which is truly multi-stakeholder, and where we look at industry's interests, you look at civil society's interests, you look at academia's interests and suggestions, and of course government's interests. And you know, I think the other thing which we have to accept is that the whole pattern of how we're going to use the internet has changed. It was started in the US. The US was a pioneer in this, and the West. You know that I've said this before in many fora, but I think it's important to remember that today in the world, the largest number of users of the internet are Chinese. The second largest are Indians. And of course, I hope that one day the Indians and Chinese will be neck to neck, and India might even be ahead. But given that, you know, to have the kind of system that you have, where most of the root servers are in the US, with I think just one in Europe, if I'm not mistaken, you know, is not tenable in the future. So something has to change about the system of internet governance. But you know, I think the most important thing is that we have to protect the internet itself. And that's why I think the first norm that the Global Commission came out with, the call to protect the public core of the internet, for me is very, very important. Because you're actually, in a way, what we're saying, you know, there's been a lot of talk about whether cyberspace and whether the internet is a global commons or not. Some people like to call it a global commons, but I think this much is true, that it's a public good. This much is true, that it's an international good. And therefore, you know, you can't really go on the way you have, because it's no longer something that was just created in one country. It's become a universal medium. So you have to find a universal way to regulate it.
I do think, too, there are some fundamental questions and differences among various groups of people that we've been discussing for a while, and there may never be complete consensus, but clearly have to be thought through. One is this notion of the role of civil society and the private sector in norms development, because historically, governments saw these government-to-government questions as government questions. So it's for, you know, the Foreign Office and the State Departments, and it's not for the private sector and civil society to have a seat at the table. So, for example, I, in my past life, I was at the OECD as part of the U.S. delegation. I was actually vice chair of one of the groups. And the Business Industry Advisory Committee by BIAC had a seat at the table. But they weren't influential in a large way in deciding what the 28 nation states were going to do with these various issues. And we're talking about a fundamentally different model where the influence of non-government stakeholders is much larger than in the past. And not surprisingly, there are government stakeholders who don't think that's the right approach. The other thing, of course, is the notion of the internet being an international public good. That's absolutely true. But at the same time, there are countries that are trying to isolate themselves and say, well, okay, this notion that it's just global and that it's just one big pie isn't really the way we think about it. And we need rules for our people, and we're going to enforce our rules. And there's this question of the segmentation of the internet. And so that's, there are fundamental points of view about whether this should be managed globally or more locally. And, you know, that's also a legitimate question. And then the third aspect, of course, is what is the internet good for? There are some countries who say it's a great bastion of free speech and democratic ideals and all of that. And there are other countries who say that speech can represent a security threat to the nation if it's not regulated, and we don't see it the way these other countries see it. And these are kind of fundamental philosophical and differences. And different value systems. And it's not going to be harmonized, but we have to figure out within that reality, what things can you address in an effective way? And on what places are people going to agree to disagree? And if they do agree to disagree, what is the impact of that on this international public good?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's been great talking with both of you about the future of the internet and the work of the Global Commission on the Stability of Cyberspace. So I want to thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Remember to look for EWI Podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and iTunes under the name of East-West Institute, where you can listen, follow, and subscribe so you won't miss our conversations. Thank you for listening.